This is Baker Lake and Skagit River Sockeye Salmon Review Briefing and Public Comment. Aaron Defoe and Edward Eliezer. Take it away, gentlemen, when you're ready.
All righty. Thank you for having me here. Chair Carpenter, commissioners, directors, my name is Aaron Defoe. I'm a salmon policy analyst with the Fish Program. Sitting next to me is Edward Eliezer. He's the Region 4 Fish Program Manager. We're going to get right into it. We'll give you a quick, brief summary of kind of Baker sockeye management, so we're all speaking the same language, and then give you an update on the 2019 returns and fishing season, and then how we're trying to address harvest equity in this fishery, including meetings with key stakeholders and some analyses that spawned from that. Lastly, I'll let Edward hit cleanup and talk about hatchery production and future plans for the fishery. So to give everybody a lay of the land, in the bottom left corner we have Skagit Bay with the Skagit River running horizontally through the map there. Then we have the confluence of the Baker River with the Baker Trap, and then the Baker Lake and Lake Shannon. Various tribes have UNA that spans from the marine waters in Skagit Bay all the way up and past the Baker Trap, but into the Baker River as well. The state sport fishery occurs in both the lower river and Orange there, as well as the primary fishery, and the majority of harvest takes place in Baker Lake in the top right corner. So that Baker Trap is the primary source of data we have to manage this fishery in season. So we count fish as they're trapped and then distributed into the lake or to the hatchery. Those trap counts are extremely flow dependent. They're quite variable from day to day. And you can see the graph to the right there, the green line is the trap counts from this last year. So they do vary quite a bit. There is a 10-day migration time from the mouth of the Skagit River, where some fisheries are taking place, to the Baker Trap. An additional piece of information that hasn't come online yet are treaty test fisheries. Those occur in various spots in the bay and the lower river. At this point, they were started in 2012. The data sets at this point aren't useful for in-season management, but that is the hope. We'll keep you updated on how those go. We use those Baker Trap counts in what we call ISU models or in-season update models. So they use those Baker Trap counts to predict a total run size through a relationship. The reliability of those predictions greatly increases after we see half the run show up. And so we're fitting models to basically a scatter of data. And until we see that peak, we have no idea when the run timing is. It's a pretty big unknown. The average timing is around the 14th, 15th of July. And that migration time, that 10-day migration time, limits the effectiveness of those in-season update models. So fisheries are occurring in the lower river, and fish are passing through there 10 days prior than we have an idea of abundances rolling past. This is a graph that shows Baker sockeye run size through time. The very first value is a three-decade average from 1960 to 1990. And then you can see starting right around 2010, we had some pretty good increases in run size. These are largely the result of infrastructure improvements, both at the Baker Trap, at the hatchery, as well as the smolt capture facilities to get smolts out of the lake. In 2019, we had a preseason forecast of just under 34,000. The return came in at quite a bit below that, at 22,440. The constituent parts of that run size include test fisheries, treaty harvest, recreational catch in river, what's distributed into the lake, and then brood stock as well. And so the treaty harvest value there of just under 8,700 Some folks might be wondering, what's the comparable value of what our share, what the state share is, relative to the treaty harvest? And so the rec share is what's caught in the river, that 582, and then it's what is distributed into the lake. Now, the kind of caveat to that is we have a 1,500 natural escapement goal in the lake. And so for 2019, if there was a comparable value to the treaty harvest share, it would be that 3,423, which again is that what goes into the lake minus that 1,500, and then what's caught in the river. So that 22,440 return was 33% below the preseason forecast value. We did see some pretty, we don't often see region-wide productivity trends with Baker relative to other regional sockeye stocks. This was an exception this year we did. Fraser had the lowest return on record at less than 500,000 fish. Their forecast came in at about 10% of the entire forecast, so there were some pretty strong marine conditions that were playing a role here. Columbia River return was also about half of what we forecast. So this is a graph that shows state versus tribal harvest shares over time. In the gray is treaty harvest. In the black is the state harvest share. And you can see starting in 2010 through 2012, we were relatively close on sharing, with the state getting just a few more fish annually than the treaty fishers. And then you see another trend kind of from 2016 on and primarily in the last 3 years where there's been a pretty good harvest inequity between the state and the tribes. And there's a pretty easy explanation for all of this, and that is forecast performance. So every year that the state ends up harvesting, in the end, more fish than the tribes, it is a year where the run size comes in above forecast. The converse is also true. Every time the run comes in below forecast, based off our limited ability to update the run, that migration timing, and when we can influence fisheries, without exception, if the run comes in below what we had anticipated, the tribes will end up harvesting more in the end. Another way to look at that data is to just plot up the numbers for you. And so over that long-term sharing from 2010 to 2019, on a total harvest, you can see, while not perfectly equal, is not incredibly disproportional. We see annual harvest rates that, or at least average annual harvest, that's relatively equal, but again, starting to diverge as well. When we look at the recent 3 years, this is what I think most of the anglers are very well aware of. We've had some really rough years where the harvest on average is about half of what the treaty harvest is. So again, while the long-term sharing is on par, we think that there's a much, we can hold ourselves to a higher standard and get greater harvest equity between the state and tribes on a shorter time period. So this has been an ongoing issue that I've come to the commission to present about in the past, as well as we've had some Baker sockeye workshops with public constituents. And we identified a variety of ways to address this harvest equity. I'll briefly describe each of these. Technical fixes, this is getting at in-season update performance, preseason forecast, fixes to the technical tools that we use to manage the fishery. Both buffer harvest shares and conservative preseason planning have the intended outcome of limiting the number of fish that are harvested up until we have confirmation with an in-season update. And so that would put fewer fish in either party's share until we can update the run. An expanded river fishery would just allow the state to take a greater portion of their harvest share before we update the run lower in the river. This wouldn't have a great impact on the state tribal harvest sharing, but it would make a small dent. And then payback. So, yes. Oh, sorry. Payback is essentially if we do have provisions in the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan that if either party exceeds their share by a certain criteria, that payback would then be owed. That's the...
Is that payback in what?
In fish that would occur the following year, if that makes sense. It's something that we haven't collectively done in a couple decades in fisheries that I'm aware of, but it is a tool at our disposal.
Commissioner McIsaac?
Yes.
Follow up on that. I'll hold the rest of my questions from earlier slides till the end, but has the payback provision that's in the plan been used successfully in the past in this spot or elsewhere in Puget Sound?
That is a great question. Not in this fishery, and to my knowledge, it hasn't been used. I might, when we get to questions, Ron may have a better sense of that. But my understanding is it hasn't been used in, at least in Puget Sound, I think in a couple decades, is my understanding.
Mr. Anderson.
Can I amend that you asked with regard to various different species? So are you referring to coho as well, or just to sockeye? Or
I'm speaking to salmon in general, salmon so in general. Across the species. And again, if maybe when I'm done, if Ron can weigh in, if he's aware, but I do not believe it has occurred.
Come on up, Ron. It might be easier for you all.
I think you recall a long-term discussion about coho payback from years past, and it's a little fuzzy back there. But.
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, to try to answer your question, that in recent times, the only payback provisions that we've had to put into place are those that come in the chum fishery from the Pacific Salmon Commission. And those have worked. They're documented processes of how you're going to do it. And then the bilateral committees work out details through the fisheries to assure that we complete that process properly. So.
Mr. Thorburn?
Since we're asking questions, are these just ideas that have been developed through the workshops and the previous commission presentation? Have they yet been presented to co-managers? Has that discussion started? Or is it? Are you saying this might come forward in North of Falcon?
Thanks. These were developed both through those workshops as well as discussions with key stakeholders. We have brought up, we've worked through, I think we'll get to this kind of at the end, but we've kind of exhausted our technical fixes. We've worked through, I think, everyone that we can identify. But we have had discussions. I can't recall, to be honest with you, if we've called out individual ones out of these. I know we brought up payback and some other things. But I don't know with regards to buffer harvest shares and the conservative preseason planning. I don't actually know if they've been brought up in specifically, but we did bring this issue up during North of Falcon last year.
Continue.
So post 2019 North of Falcon, we've been trying to check off a variety of things to set the stage for future policy discussions on this matter to take place. Myself and some other staff developed an earlier time in-season update model that we got agreed to and started using this year for management. It does have an earlier look than our trap counts. It uses tribal or treaty catch data. This year when we did use it, it wouldn't have appreciably changed the outcome of the season. It was predicting a lower run size earlier in the season, but the end of the season tribal harvest was still below what would have been predicted with that. After the season, we've had meetings with key stakeholders on the issue, on the Baker Sockeye harvest equity issue, and trying to identify and move towards a solution to that. We've also, from those meetings, spawned some analyses on the preseason forecast, looking at marine indicators. I'll touch a little bit more on that in a minute because it's so influential to the outcome of the seasons. We did have a technical staff meeting held in early November, where we agreed to a harvest sharing data set. This limited some discussions from taking place during North of Falcon last year, and then some steps to improve in-season communication. So again, because the preseason forecast is so influential in how the season plays out for our fishers, that made sense to go through what analyses we have and to ensure folks that we're using the best available data we have. So we started using a new forecast model in 2018, and we used it again in an updated version in 2019 that incorporates the North Pacific Gyre Oscillation. This is a climate index that summarizes variability in primary productivity, temperature, salinity in the North Pacific. We see a really strong correlation with what's happening with the North Pacific Gyre Oscillation and Baker sockeye survival. It's also an indicator used for a lot of salmonid survival in forecasts. So what we did was, with the updated data we had, we relooked at a suite of environmental variables that can predict marine survival. Through those analyses, we can confirm that we are still continuing to use the best indicator of marine survival that we have at our availability. Looking at the graph there, the bars are the run size, and then you have in blue this newer NPGO model, and then the old model, which was used up through the 2017 season. And you can see that through a core part of the time series, they don't seem to deviate much, but when we get to when productivity started to drop off following 2015, you can see these models start to diverge pretty significantly. And while the model does a much better job of predicting marine survival, it is absolutely not perfect. We don't have that ability in San Juan to forecast. In 2018, we were about 11% below the run was 11% below the forecast. That is within the margin of error of any of our forecasts. So despite in any SAM-modded forecast, if we see numbers that are in that range, we're reasonably happy. However, in 2019, we had the return was 33-34% below the forecast, which created some really strong harvest equity issues for this season.
Aaron?
Yes.
Mr. Baker has a question.
Sure.
Despite the latest blip, that chart is very illuminating. If the problem with harvest inequity has to do with forecasting and we need better forecasters, so maybe we found a better forecast model. My question is, whatever you called that model, who knows what the components of it are that make it a better model? And my question is, can we mine those components to the extent that there's anything there that we could change to up the survival of the fish?
Gotcha. So in this fishery, we have fry that are put into both Lake Shannon and Baker Lake. And for sockeye, their marine survival is quite high relative to other species, and that makes sense because they're going out after spending a year and a half in the lake, and they're much larger than pink or chum fry when they're going out, for example. And so they do have some pretty good marine survival. Across the time series here, we've seen marine survivals that range, I think, about 2.5% all the way up to 10%. And so those are much higher than what we see for Chinook, for example, in Puget Sound, especially wild Chinook. And whether we hit or miss the mark, that's the biggest unknown in our forecast, that marine survival. So historically, that old model didn't have any predictor of marine survival. We're using averages. This now tracks the ocean conditions that we know influence that. With that said, in 2019, the return was actually out of the bounds of our model, which the short way to kind of give some information on that is the data set that trained our model couldn't have predicted that value. With that said, that doesn't really help from a statistical point. That's helpful for us to relay, but it doesn't help the fishery. And so while we're using the best model possible, it further highlights that in the absence of another tool to kind of address harvest equity, the preseason forecast will always have variability, and we will have more years that have the run coming in drastically above or below. That's just the limitations of our knowledge of marine survival. But with the constituent parts, there's really nothing else we can data mine that improves our outlook on the forecast or the marine survival of the species. We've tried, Edward will speak to this a little bit, but we've looked at different release strategies to see if we can increase marine survival. But those are a pretty minor part of the release, and maybe that's a good segue to pass it off to Edward, unless there's more questions.
Commissioner McKaysey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The blue line you're saying is the better performer. It's curious that for 8 consecutive years the run came in bigger than predicted until you started using it. This is the indicator of marine survival.
Correct.
So What else in the forecast is there that might be a source of error? So you're applying marine survival times a number of smolts or parents, or what else is in the forecast?
Thank you for that. Yes, so we have really good smolt enumeration both in Baker Lake and Lake Shannon. So we have a really solid estimate of how many fish go out. We think there's largely minimal predation in the river as they're migrating out. And so when we're talking about marine survival, it's really them getting released and making the migration down the Skagit River. Can you repeat part of your question? My mind blanked on me.
So is it simply number of smolts times marine survival? That's the forecast?
That is the forecast. The other kind of caveat to that is, as most of you are probably aware, there's different age classes of sockeye. The most difficult age class to predict is the four-year-old. We don't see we use a sibling model that predicts other age classes, but it's the primary component in predicting that marine survival that makes up the bulk of the forecast. And you're right, it is just smolt times a marine survival rate, which is influenced by that climate index.
I'm now going to pivot and talk about what the co-managers and Puget Sound Energy are doing to expand and optimize the size of the program at Baker Lake. In 2011, phase one of the hatchery facility was completed. This was part of a hydroelectric settlement agreement that was reached in 2008. As part of the agreement, a state-of-the-art hatchery is built, and as a result of the initial rebuild, we saw the entire system grow from 99 returning adults in 1985 to 50,000 adults that we saw just a few years ago, creating this popular fishery. Now that the co-managers and Puget Sound Energy are embarking on phase two of the project, this phase is designed to expand the program to reach the co-managers' goal of having 100,000 adults coming back to the system annually. We will be doing this by increasing the rearing capacity of the hatchery, upgrading the infrastructure to support these goals. With that said, the co-managers are proceeding cautiously. As you can see in this picture with Baker Lake, these systems are natural ecosystems. The fry live there for the first year of their life cycle within it and depend on the natural food sources in those lakes. And so we don't want to crash those systems, and so we're ramping up the production gradually. All indications so far show that we are not reaching carrying capacity in the lake. The fry that are coming out are very robust and do not show that there's any lack of feed in those lakes. So there's plenty of room in the future to grow this program. Prior to the settlement agreement in 2008, the smolt releases were too small to have a meaningful fishery. You can see in the graph, with the new hatchery coming online in 2010-11, the difference in increased smolt production. The different colors in the bars show the breakout of what we're doing in our co-manager release strategies. You can see with the major blue, that's Baker Lake. We're now putting more and more fish into Lake Shannon, as we're seeing there's a lot more natural feed in the lake, Daphnia, that the sockeye feed on predominantly. And then we have a delayed release program where we keep the sockeye in the hatchery for up to a year. That part of the program's really small. We get better freshwater survival out of that program, but we are very... we consider the fitness loss. They're not being chased around by bull trout for a year, so once they hit that marine environment, their survival's a lot lower because they're not adapted to outmaneuvering predators. Another thing I wanted to add, you'll probably hear in the testimony here, is out of the 9 million fry we release, a small portion of those eggs are taken for a program in the Hood Canal at the Saltwater Park facility. Between 100,000 eggs and 500,000 eggs are transferred to that program as part of a settlement agreement. And that program has been going on for 4 years, and we continue to work with stakeholders on the adaptive language management of that plan and the plan going forward. We will be having public workshops in the near future to kind of discuss the viability of that program to see how useful that seed stock was. And so this year is the first year we should be seeing returning adults to that facility, so we'll have better resolution for having future conversations. And this is the final slide, future plans. Prioritize the Baker Sockeye harvest equity in 2020 North Falcon season process. We did this last year. We had really good conversations, and we're one thing that was daylighted in our conversations that we were using two sets of books. And so now we have co-manager agreed to technical data, and so we can start addressing this equity issue in a more meaningful manner. We plan on getting some meetings on the books before North of Falcon, because as we all know, Chinook and some bigger issues can show up. We're going to continue to work with angler groups to improve opportunity. This would include expanding recreational opportunity into the town of Concrete. As I spoke earlier, working through the AG implementation plan and other projects. Aaron talked about annually updating and evaluate technical tools used to manage the fishery, and that is using the best model possible to predict that fishery. And the hatchery improvement leading to more production. We hope to see our goal of 100,000 returning adults in the next 10-year time frame and the harvest equity to be resolved.
Thank you. That was excellent. I really like the second bullet there in the last slide, to continue to work with angler groups to improve opportunity. There's a lot of expertise in the region, as you know, and a lot of passion. And a lot of times we do this. We work with groups, but we don't put it in the plan. So I think seeing it there is a very good thing. Thank you.
Let me just jump in on what Commissioner Smith said. I was sitting here. I mean, maybe you do it. Maybe you've talked about it. I know staff is fully engaged in their work, no doubt about that. Are there any volunteer opportunities? Are there anything that the constituents could engage with on any opportunities for solving some problems, working on issues of any kind?
Thank you, Chair. I know there's no easy low-hanging fruit here, and so it's pretty difficult. I know there's some endeavors looking into putting a sonar array, and so we can get a quicker time abundance estimate on the Skagit. We've worked with angler groups on doing trash cleanups on the Skagit, but that harvest equity piece, that's the hardest piece, right? And I don't know where that stakeholder engagement can come other than supporting the growth of this program and our co-manager relations.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Anderson and Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you. trying to figure out exactly how to phrase this. I know the efforts being made to refine the preseason forecast models. I mean, you probably spent a lot more time than you ever would have thought you would have spent trying to understand all that. But obviously, that seems to be the key to a lot of this. And Ed, you know, I appreciate the work that you're doing, and want to articulate the need to continue to do that. And I believe that that's consistent across, you know, between the co-managers and the and the state regarding trying to improve that forecast. So I want to encourage you to, you know, continue that, because it seems like that's where the rub is in terms of, if you can't get that right, then you're over this way or you're under this way, and then nobody's happy. And I think we all jump to solutions, you know, like, okay, let's have a buffer, let's have payback and all that kind of stuff. And for every one of those ideas, there's probably half a dozen reasons why they may not be a great idea. If you look across rivers and basins and different species and the implications of with different co-managers, and it gets really complicated really quick. So getting to the technical piece is, I think, very critical, and I think should be supported by all.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think on slide number 5, you had a display of the historic run sizes. Yeah, that's the one. And it's a pretty dramatic slide that something's gotten a lot better. So it's always nice to see positive news here. And you said that there has been some improvements in the smolt attraction or the transport or something. There's also been the hatchery element coming into play. In these recent years of big runs, what is the hatchery wild ratio, and what is the improvement in smolt attraction that would be involved here? I mean, a lot of the smolts, I presume, stay residualized and are kokanee and would like to get to the ocean, but just don't. But is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I can comment on that. So we actually don't have a great estimate currently of how much natural production takes place. So predominantly, to our knowledge, the vast majority of production is likely hatchery. There are both stream and lake spawners in the lake. However, the public utility drops the level of the lake pretty substantially, and so we, given our understanding at this point, we think that natural production is at least not a dominant player, and so the predominant production is hatchery. With that said, do you have to add the hatchery piece as far as
that? No, without the hatchery, we wouldn't have any sockeye production. As they drop the lake, the channels that the sockeye spawn in become high and dry at times, and we see switching of the channels by up to 100 yards. And so the consensus between the scientists is that the hatchery production is driving almost 100% of that production.
And to add to your whether fish are residualizing as kokanee, while we know it does occur, it's not... The vast majority of fish are still heading out. We don't have kind of a... my understanding is there's not a huge kokanee population given the number of smolts that we are that are making their way out of either of the lakes. So at least that's my understanding. So.
And then thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up on Commissioner Anderson's... on your last slide, future plans, prioritizing harvest equity in the next round of season setting. So we've gotten public testimony in writing that talks about the, what is it, six of the last 7 years or something like that, that the tribal share has gone higher than the non-tribal share. In terms of what to do about that to try to make things different, you had a list of things, one of which was the buffer. And on the Columbia River, we've got a buffer situation for spring Chinook that's about a 30% buffer until the run size proves up. However, the broad nature of the run timing still allows the lower river, which in this case would be the tribal fishery, to have some sort of possibility after the update. But given the 6 out of 7 years or the recent year patterns or some of that, is the buffer concept part of what the state is taking into these negotiations, and is the are the tribal folks receptive to the idea that 6 out of 7 years warrants doing something differently than what has been done in terms of the in-season management or the pre-season forecast, or doing something different?
Thank you. I would say at this point, we have, like I said, last year we did bring up our issues during North of Falcon. In those discussions, we kind of laid out the variety of options that you've seen. We discussed through some of them. At this point, I don't think I could say we're seeing eye to eye on the issue and how to address it. I mean, that's co-management and working through that. With that said, as far as
the tribal perspective on buffer idea, for example, those years when the run size comes in above forecast, the tribes do have the opportunity to top up their share by taking fish directly from the trap. Like our anglers, the tribal representatives have communicated that they want to fish for their fish and not show up and get them out of a tote. And so the concern from their perspective on that is tribes that are fishing in the lower river, and given that migration time and when we could update the run, if you put a buffer in place, would they have the ability to catch their full share? I understand that argument, but that needs to be weighed against the series of years that produced that harvest inequity. And so it's a dynamic conversation going forward, but I think that's one of the options that we're considering, but also trying to be careful about how we go about those conversations. So,
but you are taking that into the negotiations?
Yes. At this point, we haven't said we think this is the best option to solve our problems. Again, last year during North of Falcon, when we laid out our issues and talked about some potential ways to address that, as Edward described a little bit earlier, that we were using essentially an unagreed-to data set, and folks had disagreement on what harvest on any particular year was or was not. So we worked through to try to get that agreed to, so that isn't an argument that can at least stall out those discussions.
Okay, Commissioner Keel, and if there's no objection, we will better get started on public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the third bullet, annually update, evaluate technical tools used to manage fishery. So you mentioned work that's ongoing, trying to look at tribal test fisheries in order to come up with a more timely update of the run or better indication. And then I think you said it's not really ready for prime time yet. You're still gathering years. Two questions. When would you, well, first of all, the first question would be your preliminary analysis, does it show any promise as a reliable predictor of run size? That's the first question.
Thanks. There are multiple tribal test fisheries. There's, I believe, three in total. And at this point, while I think one of them shows some promise, when we look at in-season update models and kind of the how much variability is explained by looking at that one tribal catch in that one area in that test fishery, I think there's a little bit left to be desired there. It doesn't quite have as strong a relationship as we would hope. That is partly what led myself and others to try to look at that alternative in-season update model that we started using this last year, which uses tribal catch. And the reason why it's probably a better predictor is just the sheer numbers of fish and boats that are participating that give you a better census of the run. So as opposed to one boat drifting, you have their entire fleet fishing, and there's a relationship with their catch per unit effort in that fishery to the total run size. And so I think at this point, if I had to say what a better option would be, I know that the relationship with that with the actual tribal catch data is much stronger than the test fishing data sets at this point.
Okay, and so then just the follow-up then is, when do you expect to, how many more years of data do you think you need and more evaluation before you can really use this as an agreed tool that has to be agreed to by the tribal co-managers as well?
Absolutely. That is a great question, and since I've been with the department, there haven't been too many test fisheries that came online. We've been using kind of historical data sets that are really powerful, and so there's no one answer on when they would become available, but I would say at this point that kind of a ballpark would be, if you're not seeing something promising in a 10-year time period, my own opinion would be to cut your losses and switch gears and try to find something that maybe does have a relationship. But again, these are tribal test fisheries, and there's collectively we value the results of that model, but we haven't had discussions about when do you make that decision on the tribal side and as co-managers to switch gears to find something that may show more promise? So we haven't had those discussions. But at this point, if you're not seeing something in 10 years, I think that's when you start wanting to have these conversations.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, we're moving to public comment on this issue only. I'd like to say before we start, we don't want to short anybody their time. Everybody has a right and opportunity to say what they need to say. We do have some commissioners that have to travel to the east side and long distances. So if, Bill, you come up, and right behind Bill is Tom, and Bill said exactly what you're going to say, Tom, say, I agree with Tom. If we can save a few minutes, great, but don't short yourself. This is an important issue. Fair enough? All right, Steve Franson, Ron Robertson, and John Westerfield. Steve, take it away.
What, him again?
No, I didn't say that.
You'll like this, I hope. No attacks here. This is a message with a different tone and purpose. It's about, or not about, but using institutional memory. I first became associated with the Baker River Project and the sockeye salmon there in 1979. So I had noticed low adult salmon returns, but talking to folks at Puget Sound Energy, we didn't take any action until Edward mentioned in 1985, only 99 adult sockeye salmon returned to the Baker. Prior to that time, there had always been like 1,000, 2,000, between 1,000 and 3,000 fish. So it didn't, while it was not what we liked, it wasn't scary. 99 is scary low. So the fish biologist at Puget Sound Energy called me to report this information. And not wanting Baker Sockeye to wink out and go extinct on his watch, he suggested we meet and see if we could do something. I was with the Skagit System Co-op then, and so I contacted colleagues at the old Fisheries and Game Departments, as well as Fish and Wildlife Service and NIMS. And so we met as an ad hoc group and began calling ourselves the Baker River Committee. Not as cool as Occupy Skagit, but it served our purposes. And we adopted the task of just halting the decline of Baker sockeye and reversing that trend towards population restoration. And I suspected, as some others did at the outset, that poor juvenile downstream migration was the culprit. But as one might expect, Puget wasn't about to accept that because that impugns their project without proof. So we did our due diligence and demonstrated that it wasn't the treaty gillnet fishery in the river in Skagit Bay or the treaty and non-treaty sockeye fishing fleets in the San Juan Islands that were causing this decline of Baker River sockeye. Different run timings being a big thing. And anyway, so we did a series of experiments and demonstrated that, in fact, it was low downstream passage that were the proximate cause of the declining sockeye and also coho abundance in the Baker system. So early experiments actually hinted at a better future with a return of 14,000 sockeye as early as 1994. That kind of put Baker sockeye on the radar screen down at the old fisheries department. It's like, what's this going on? And my colleague reported to Jim Ames, who was the sockeye and pink salmon guy in Olympia at the time, was, well, we're working on it. And this was one of the good results of that. So, oh crap, already? As smolt passage improved, I would mention kokanee fishing did decline in Baker Lake. And a prior version of you folks did receive complaints from local anglers of where are the kokanee in Baker Lake, and blaming Puget Sound Energy. And Puget Sound Energy was the culprit here because they were working with the agencies and tribes to try to improve juvenile downstream passage. They weren't quick to open their checkbook, but eventually they did. Hydro project relicensing came to pass, and we have $100 million worth of floating surface collectors on Baker and Shannon Lakes. In at least 1 year, maybe more, over 1 million juvenile salmon have been attracted and collected through downstream passage and safe passage to the sea then. So I'm really pleased that you guys have a problem that we have so many salmon that now you have to figure out how to sort out the catch.
Thanks,
so,
Steve.
Just appreciate thought you might
comments.
Be interested
we'll
in
see
that.
We'll see you again, I'm sure. Ron Roberts, yes. Welcome.
I'm a member of Puget Sound Angler, and my family has been, traces its back to the early 1900s in Skagit County. And I've got five grandkids, and I'm kind of protecting their interest right here. There's no young people here, and I'm kind of speaking out for them. Right now I'm having a hard time with my younger kids, keeping them from just doing this all day instead of doing this. And the Baker River fishery was something that I got those guys involved in. Also, they were pretty successful with some of our humpy years. We kind of lost that this year, and so I didn't have them with me. Regrettably, a lot of them aren't patient enough to go king salmon fishing with me unless I go to Canada. I just want to say protect this for my grandkids because I really want for the rest of my life to be able to go fish and enjoy their company and our resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. John Westerfield.
Good morning, Director Susswind and members of the commission. My name is John Westerfield. I am a fisher, but I am also the corporate vice president and general manager of Jaeger Sporting Goods here in Bellingham, which is a 98-year-old fishing and hunting store. Quick question. How many of you have ever fished Baker Lake for sockeye? Any of you? Why don't you come and see me next summer and we'll take you fishing. I think that the Baker Lake fishery needs to be looked at as a very unique and very special fishery because it allows the guy with a 10-foot boat and a 2.5-horse motor to go fish for the best fish in the world in a safe environment in one of the most beautiful places on the planet. He can't do that in Puget Sound. He can take the wife, he can take the kids in a small boat, they can be safe and have a great fishery. But we need to have the fish there for him. So I think it should be kept in mind that this is, in fact, a unique and special fishery. Also, the salmon is, in fact, the real symbol of the Northwest. Once they've seen Mount Rainier and Mount Baker and put their arms around a great big fir tree, the next thing people who come to visit me from Texas, Arkansas, Wyoming, Virginia, Maryland, Georgia, and Florida, the next thing they want to do is go salmon fishing, and they want to see a salmon. They want to eat a salmon. So when we see these numbers and we see what's going on here, and we say to ourselves, why is it such a mess? Well, the mess is that we continually allow a projection that is unrealistic. It's inflated. It's not right. 22,000 fish came back this year. That should be the top of the projection for next year. Something else I would invite you to do is come stand around our fishing tackle department sometime around July and listen to what your customers have to say. You know, these people are your customers. They're mine and yours. And they are the people who pay the bills, and they buy the licenses, and they stand at our counter and gripe all day long about everything. Okay? That's what I get paid to listen to. Maybe you should hear some more of it, too.
We don't get paid, though.
I'm sorry about that. Now,
I don't gripe to you.
No. The exception is Brad Smith. Okay? Now, I promise to be brief. So, recognizing the disparity that's gone on, the one thing I keep seeing, looking for in this and don't see, is a comparison chart of projection versus reality. We know what it was for last year, but for how many years was that the case? Almost every year. So, in closing, this phone has been lit up all morning long. It's my wife. She's a wonderful lady, but she loves to fish, and she's reminding me that she has not caught a fish in Baker Lake in 3 years. Now, you don't have to live with this woman, but I do, so please, let's fix this.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Okay, Brian Townley, Heath Eichela, and Roger Gooden. Yes, you got it.
Okay, I'll go try to save time. This is an important fishery for CCA. You may know there is a Baker Lake sockeye shootout that we hold every July. It's one of the three derbies CCA Washington does. It is a great event. What's already been said, I mean, kids can go out there, families. The weather's fantastic in July. Mount Baker in the background. If you're looking to recruit kids into fishing, there is no better place than a place like Baker Lake to do that. But as these guys have already said, fish have got to be there. And maybe in one of the rare occurrences, I'm going to say I completely agree with Commissioner McIsaac. Look at what's going on Spring Chinook and how we manage that on the Columbia. We have a buffer we place on it. I will tell you, if the non-tribal side overfished 6 out of 7 years in terms of sharing, the tribes would have us into court in a heartbeat. Now, we're in a little bit of a different situation right now, but there's just no excuse not to figure this out and moving forward. So I want to encourage you. It sounds like things are already happening in terms of the forecasts that are positive, but to continue this out moving forward. So we've got some of our chapter leadership that are going to speak, including Roger Gooden and Bob Cooper, and I also just want to thank you all for your service, each and every one of you. As Mr. Kehoe said, you don't get paid for this. I think people need to understand this, and you get to sit and listen to a lot of people saying a lot of things. So thank you for all of your service.
Brian?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank the commission for allowing me to talk here. I represent the Steelhead Trout Club. I'm Brian Townley. Frank Urebeck couldn't make it, so he's having me speak for on behalf of the club. Anyways, I'm just going to go ahead and read a quick statement and go ahead and let the next individual go ahead and speak. But our group in cooperation with other sport fishing organizations has advocated for the fair and equitable sharing of harvestable sockeye beginning in 2014. And since the peak run of 53,000 sockeye in 2015, the return to the Skagit has plummeted to less than half this number, to only 22,000 this year. 5 of the last 6 years, actual numbers of sockeye have fallen short of preseason forecast, resulting in unfairness in harvest, favoring the Skagit Basin tribes. During those 6 years, nearly 28,000 more sockeye were harvested by the tribes than made available for harvest by sport anglers. With the crash of the once popular Lake Washington sockeye fishery in 2007, and more recently the disappearance of the Columbia River sockeye fishery out of Brewster, Washington, the Skagit and Baker recreational fisheries provide the only remaining recreational opportunity for these popular salmon. While only a relatively few sockeye are taken by hook and line from the Skagit River, which 580,000 this past summer, Baker Lake is where most of the action has taken place, with some peak activity days as many as 150 boats ranging from kayaks to 20-foot jet sleds trolling the lake. In 2015, over 19,000 sockeye were put into the lake for sport harvest, compared with 2,800 only in 2019. It was the worst fishery since PSE began releasing sockeye into Baker Lake in 2010. In conclusion, we were promised by the department staff at a public workshop held in Mill Creek a little over a year ago that harvest inequity would be addressed prior to the North of Falcon process by the co-managers, and that did not happen. We're asking the commission direct the department to give Baker sockeye harvest equity a high priority for the 2020 season. Engaging the three Skagit Basin tribes on behalf of sport fishing license holders in a transparent manner that allows the public to track the discussions. This should be accomplished before the North of Falcon 2020 gets started. Options that should be on the table include a use of a preseason run forecast buffer, as we've talked about before, as has been done on the Columbia River, following year payback via harvest adjustments, and use of professional judgment to adjust the preseason forecast resulting from current run forecast model. And then one other thing I'd just like to add, there's been a real bad trend lately with tribal inequity. I got about 4 or 5 rivers that I should be fishing down south right now. They're all closed. The kids want to go fish and they can't go fish. And there's nets in them right now. So I just want you to take that into consideration, because it's a trend that's going downhill fast. Thank you.
Roger?
I'm Roger Gooden from CCA North Sound, which is Skagit Island, Whatcom Counties. I made this same talk to you, Commissioner, in September 17th when we talked about the Wildlife Commission meeting in Olympia. The harvest inequity was in error, and as we have today, it's now at 26% inequity. And so we have a conservation problem. We've heard that many times. We would like to return to equitable sharing, and we would like this to become a priority project within the department. We believe that conservation has to come first, and we think that the 30% buffer should be put in on top of the statistical services that have been put in by the department, and put that into place. Secondly, with a buffer in place, we should go to mid-season management, because as all of these fish come up to the Baker Lake Dam, they're caught and they're trucked uphill. We know day after day exactly how many fish are going into the lake. So this would be an easy one to manage on a continuous basis. To increase the ability for reducing inequity, we should address harvesting all the way from right now Mount Vernon all the way up to the Baker River. Right now it's stopped well below there. Let's expand the area that the recreationals can fish. And lastly, just to go something a little bit outside, let's take a large North Pacific view of this. The impact of fisheries from global changes has become quite significant. For instance, the mouth of the Skeena River, the second largest river in BC, is 30 miles below the Alaska border. This summer, because of very low returns, salmon, sockeye, and chinook were not allowed to be caught in that river. And that river has about 10 times the volume of the Skagit. It's enormous. Yet, 30 miles away over in Alaska, they had an absolutely terrific year. And the Canadians from BC are furious at Alaska. They took all the fish. And now you can go down to Costco here in town, and it has wild-caught sockeye from Alaska. It's still on for sale. So they had a good year. So between this Oregon, Washington, BC, and Alaska, there is a whole lot of balancing that needs to take place. And then lastly, just in conclusion, with the end of Lake Washington as a great sockeye lake, we ask you, the department, to treat Baker Lake as the precious last sockeye population in Washington State. So please move to correct and grow this fish population as a priority project. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Okay, it is now Bob Cooper, Bob Harriman, and Comer LaRue. Okay, as soon as we get done with this. Six, maybe. Okay. Mr. Cooper.
Okay, thank you. A lot of the points that I have on here have already been covered, so I'm going to be brief. I'm going to highlight the ones that I think are important. I have three comments to make. All of them consider Baker Lake sockeye. That's the only thing I want to talk about. I don't want to talk about anything else. My first comment can be summed up with priority now, priority now, and priority now. This is what we're going to have to look at. We cannot wait 10 years for our data to be evaluated, to be massaged, or anything like that. The critical point of Baker Lake sockeye fishery is now. The problem is simple. The use of pre-season forecasts alone do not result in fair equity harvest sharing, particularly for the recreational fisheries. My conclusion is that the numbers and the preseason forecasts have been thoroughly worked over, and the results show an increasingly unfair harvest share for the recreational fishers. How can we expect different results when we try the same thing over and over again? The data that was presented by Aaron
justifies this. What is required now is to make a policy-mandated adjustments to the forecast estimate to better achieve equity harvest sharing for all stakeholders. The request for policy adjustments must come from you, the commissioners. That is where this thing starts. To lend the weight necessary to show the department is serious about equity for recreational fishers. This is why I say priority now, priority now, and priority now. The 2020 fishery and North of Falcon are just around the corner. Make this a priority now for the department to follow up before the 2020 season is up on us. We are tired of being led up the road of doing nothing and seeing the same unacceptable results. I'll use an example from contracting business. In contractors, we prepare budgets, we prepare AFEs. In any of these cases, regardless of the magnitude of the project, there's always a finagle factor at the bottom of any budget, a 10% kicker, whatever you want to call it, because we don't know on these projects how it's actually going to finish up at the beginning. We know at the end, but for safety's sake, we've got that 10% buffer in there. I think we need to seriously look at this. Go ahead and continue with our massaging the formulas, the equations, and trying to get better preseason forecasts, but at the same time, let's preserve our fishery with something like a buffer. And if that's my 3 minutes, or can I?
Well taken. Thank you, Bob. Mr. Herriman.
Hi. Bob Herriman again with Borderline Bass and Contenders. And like one of the previous speakers, John Westergreen, I too would like to emphasize that, you know, I started out with a big bass boat. And then I got bass rods. And then I got walleye rods. And then I got sturgeon rods. Now I have two downriggers on that same boat. And I got rods from Jaeger's to fish for Baker Lake. So our club utilizes every part of the sport fishing that we can do. And I noticed on the MPO model, and I like the idea of the buffer concept. But, you know, truly when you look at the water flows out of the Skagit this year, that was some of the lowest water I have ever seen. I've been fishing the Skagit for 30 years or more. It was so low that places that I normally go sturgeon fishing that are 18 to 20 feet deep were less than 10 feet. Those same areas. Now that tells you where the low areas are, like another previous gentleman said, getting those fish out, you have restrictions. Here's another thing too. I didn't see a graph from the department that showed salmon counts versus water level rain counts. I didn't see that. If those fish are stacking up at the mouth waiting to get up, and it's a low water situation, that is also the ideal time, and you can just look at it. The seals move right in, and they stay with those fish the whole time period until that rain level comes up again, and then they flush and go up. But those seals take advantage of that. There's many different options here, but I would recommend that in the MPO model that, you know, the negotiations with the tribes is very important, and we'd like to see that happen. And two, you need to have a little buffer just in case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Comer?
Thank you. My name's Comer LaRue. I'm the president of the Wildcat Steelheaders Club and hopefully representing their interests here today. I provided a written statement for the board, and I'm not going to go back over all of that. Most important thing I want to do here today is to thank Director Susswine for making this happen. I've written some biting statements in regards to anybody whose actions kind of don't promote this kind of coming together. I'd like to ask a question. Is there anyone here today who represents our co-managers? Would you raise your hand? That's as I suspected. It's an important observation, and it's one that I've made throughout all of my looking at what the problems are. I certainly believe that commercial fishing out in the Sound, through the Straits, all the way to Canada and Alaska, is really what our problem is. You want to know where those fish go? They go into nets. I would like to even share with you some of my observations, which I'm not going to give specifics on, but I absolutely know that the reported numbers from the tribes are not accurate. I worked in one of their courts for almost 11 years, and I worked with their fishermen, and they trusted me enough to tell me what they were actually catching. I don't know if you all know, I'm a forensic psychologist. I am an advanced trained statistician, and I never forgot one of the first things that one of my mentors said. Will Rogers pointed out, there are liars, there are damn liars, and there are statisticians. You can't trust it. I look at the numbers continually. I look at data, and I grind it. Don't go there. Go there only to get an overview of what's really gone wrong. Don't divide up this catch like has been done in the past, which is based on the financial value to interests. There's a cultural value that the tribes went to the Supreme Court and made their case. It's the most important case that they made out of the treaties, that the cultural value of those fish probably outweighs everything else. We no longer need fish as subsistence. We all know that. Most of our fish that are caught are going to go overseas. We need to begin to reevaluate what we're doing and what is the real value. And I share the value that the natives do with this, that it is a cultural heritage, and we're losing our fishermen. I was touched by Martha Hall's statement yesterday and a little astounded when I thought about it. She's correct. We are the 3%. And that's all we are. They control the money. They control where things will go in the future. And I'm going to do more to enlist that 3%. I'm going to use more of my club's facilities to get those people involved with us. We need them. And I don't think that you're short-selling them. I think they're short-selling themselves, because that 97% doesn't have a clue of what we do and how important we are and you are to the whole process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have four left. I'm going to call all four of you up at the same time. Rob Larson, Mike Stefanik, Jacob DeGraff, and Art Thomas.
Thank you.
Art Thomas had that. I'll leave a little early.
Thank you for being commissioners and for volunteering to do it. You get subjected to a lot of things that aren't always pleasant, but we do appreciate you sacrificing your personal time to represent us for things that are important to us. I'm Rob Larson. I'm representing Puget Sound Anglers, and I've been asked by Ron Garner to represent the whole state. My comments, I actually had an opportunity to read at our state board meeting a week ago and review with everybody, so they represent the president from each of the chapters, and that's significant because we have over 14 clubs and over 1,500 fishermen represented from the statements that I'm making. CCA and the Steelhead Trout Club also worked with us. We worked together to formulate the things that we're talking about today, because we all share a similar interest. What was once a really promising recreational fishery that back in 2010 with a lot of opportunity has seemed to be dwindling. And with the peak run at 5,300 fish this past year down to 2,200, as we've heard, it's sad. Six of the last 7 years, there's been numbers that are significantly less than preseason forecasts. I'm an engineer, and I use finite element analysis, And I recognize that modeling is only as good as the input of the variables. We have in this situation, and I feel sorry for the biologists that have to try to estimate this, because the variables are extremely difficult in this case. And like with metal forming that I do, a certain amount of what goes into a good prediction has to be kind of from your gut and what you know. And so you can't look at just the model. And we can see from past history that the model doesn't work perfectly, but it is better than nothing. And so you have to keep that in mind. Let's see. The numbers in the harvest has definitely favored the tribes in particular in the last 4 years. About 50% more harvest by the tribes than by the sport fishermen. And I think we need to correct that situation as soon as possible. And you've heard a lot of the ideas on how to do it. They're very similar to the ideas that we have. We've repeatedly attempted through public workshops, meetings, email exchanges, and testimony before the commission to get the Department of Wildlife to address this harvest inequity. And it sounds like we have the attention, but we really need to focus on it. And I know Frank Ehrbeck's name comes up. He's been very involved in sockeye. He wasn't here, able to be here today, but I did have conversations with him. And some of the things that he did, he's had some input to the models, but like I just said, models, they're only as good as the input. So keep that in mind. While the new model produced better results, it still was inaccurate. This year, it really missed the mark. There was about 11,000 fish miss, showed up less than the forecast, and only made 3,400 fish available for fishermen. It was really a non-fishery this year. There was a few people I know that hooked a fish up there. I didn't even go. I know of a number of people that canceled their trips as a result of that. That's significant. As we have seen in 2019 with other salmon runs where fisheries were halted or severely curtailed, there is clearly significant growing problems with marine survival and the current forecast models that we addressed. Continuing to use the current models without applying some professional overriding judgment is unacceptable. Disappointing to me that we haven't done more in the last 4 years, and I hope that we can now, and also moving forward. Sportsmen deserve better. We can do better than we have been doing.
We need to wrap her up.
Okay, we respectfully ask that the commission will do the things that we ask, the three things. Buffer, the other things that are going on.
Mike?
Thank you.
Thank you. In the interest of brevity, I will my name is Mike Stefanik. And I'm here, A, for myself, and B, as a part of the Puget Sound Anglers. I'd really like to get my grandkids up on the lake more often than I've had the opportunity for. And to that end, then, some of the things that have been mentioned here today, a buffer, better modeling, etc., all needs to be considered. And in conclusion, I want to thank all of you for your hard work and all the dedication that you put into this. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jacob DeGraff. Yeah. I am not here on behalf of anybody else, but I am a bankruptcy attorney. I represent poor people, and I am an angler for most of my life, and I fish rivers. And I personally don't care about the Baker Lake fishery because I don't have a boat to fish it. I fish on the Skagit River, and it is a remarkable fishery. Those fish are amazing. They are the freshest, most amazing salmon you will ever catch in a river, because they come into that river in June, and there are still live fish up in the Baker Lake hatchery waiting to spawn. That's how far they are, right? I mean, you catch them, and their gonads are like that. There's nowhere else I've fished that the fish are like that. And the Baker River opportunity is short, and the net impact is obvious. It is not worth fishing weekdays on that river. It's not worth taking a day off of work, because the fish aren't going to be there except in that small window on the weekends. So if you're going to prioritize, give something to the bank-bound anglers down in Burlington, Mount Vernon, who don't, some of them ride their bike to the river because they can't drive. So they're definitely not here. You know, there's a group of regular guys, and I don't see any of them here, but there's a group of regular guys that fish down at Young's Bar on the Skagit River. It's the most amazing, odd, diverse bunch of guys that you've ever seen fishing anywhere. And it really, veterans, disabled, old, young, and what brings them together is that none of them has the money to fish anywhere else, and they want to be fishing. And the past few years, that's the only in-river fishery they've had, right? Because Pink's have been closed for two cycles now. Coho were closed year before last. That's all they get. And the in-river spring Chinook fishery, they get none from the bank. You can't catch those fish from the bank. So think about the people who can't afford to spend a ton of money in the tackle stores, don't have a boat, and providing some opportunities for them in this fishery, in this calculation. If you're not giving something to the anglers in the river, the easy thing to do is, well, once we make it up to the lake, we'll just pass that chair into the lake. Well, that's very simple math, but before then, how do we provide a meaningful opportunity to the guys in the river? Thank you.
Good comments. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming in today. Question of the commission. We've been here for a while this morning. We need to do a wrap-up on this subject, I think. Do you want to take 5 minutes first or do the wrap-up and then take a five-minute break?
Wrap-up.
Okay. Comments? Mr. Anderson.
Yes, I'm interested in the capacity of the recreational fishery in terms of, might be a question for the department, in terms of catch per day that could occur. I know it all depends on volume of fishers, but just historically.
Are you speaking in the recreational fishery or the, I didn't hear the first part clearly. So you're asking for a catch per day. Could you just repeat the question? I was in the back end. Well, across the entirety of the season this year, we've seen a lot of variability in that fishery. The year that we had the absolute best catch rates in the river, where it was a year where we had extraordinarily high water and the water was very turbid, we caught over 3,000 fish in the river that year. Since then, we've had some years that have been a pretty big struggle for the river fishermen. This year, we across the entirety of the season, we had 580 fish that we estimated harvested through our creel surveys. Most of those are pretty effort dependent, but you're usually not seeing a whole lot more than kind of, on a weekend you might see close to 50 fish a day, but that's sometimes a stretch. Usually we're kind of hovering around the 20 to 30-ish, depending upon whether it's a weekend day and effort. Does that answer your question?
Partly, then, in terms of in the lake as well.
So we actually, we have creeled the lake at various points in time, but we don't have, we don't do it consistently. And it's, the anglers could attest to this, very dependent upon the numbers of fish in the lake. Yeah. Most anglers and department staff that I've talked to would suggest, until you get probably 3,000 fish in the lake, it's probably not worth your time. And so on a year like this year where we barely get 3,000 fish in the lake, catch rates are pretty dang low. And we do get catch record card estimates from them, or from the Baker Lake fishery. In any given year, I think the highest I've seen as far as not daily catch rates, but just total numbers of fish caught relative to what actually gets into the lake is about 60 to 70%. That's the kind of the top end of the range. So I don't have a specific answer to your question, but some background for you.
Not sure I had a specific question either.
Thanks. Commissioner Grayville?
I just wanted to mention, and you mentioned around 3,000 fish is enough for a fishery there. Someone testified it's the only sockeye lake opportunity in the state. We have a tremendous sockeye opportunity at Lake Wenatchee, which is about 20 miles from my home. And when we have 3,000 fish in the lake over minimum escapement, over 100 boats will be on the lake. and it is limit fishing and all the good things that other people talked about with having the grandkids out and boatloads of people having fun. It's a great example of what can happen if all the stars align. You know, we haven't had a fishery there for a couple of years, but our catch rates during that fishery are tremendous. Hopefully we'll get enough this year and you'll come over and participate in that. Anyway, there are some good sockeye fisheries. I understand the frustration. This was a great presentation. I think we know the touch points that need to be addressed, and we should move forward.
Commissioner McIsaac, and then I got Kim. You want to say something as well? I have a couple things at some point. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the presentation and all the testimony. It's a very interesting situation that I haven't been fully aware of. I always knew that Baker Lake Sockeye was one of the unique places where smolts getting over dams did work. Usually it fails. So I'd be interested later to hear a little bit about the mitigation agreement with the power company to see if there's any chances of growing the pie on that, but that's not for the subject for today. I do see Mr. North of Falcon in the back of the room, and he hasn't climbed under the table just by me calling his name. But I wondered, what we're really hearing from the testimony is what can be done to put some more definition into prioritizing Baker Lake Sockeye harvest equity in the North of Falcon season-setting process. And if he could just maybe express an opinion here, I think Commissioner Anderson was right in that there's lots of ideas, and then there's lots of reasons why ideas don't always work out so well. And I'd mentioned the buffer concept that is used on the Columbia River, Spring Chinooker in the lower river in late February and March and April and May in the first part of June, and that's a long time frame that makes that kind of buffer work. When you look at 6 out of 7 years of things not working, that if that was flipped on the other side, I think that our co-managers would be coming and asking a similar thing. Can't we try something different? We tried a different forecast the last 2 years, so that's trying something different. That didn't work out so well. But I'm just kind of wondering if there is a way, and there's a payback discussion. I would not advise getting into payback from what I know about it because, you know, we had somebody in bankruptcy court testify, and, you know, the payback situation on fish can be really bad when the runs are in declining. It's easy to pay back when runs are increasing, but it's got a lot of difficulty, as I know Commissioner Keogh knows from the Pacific Salmon Treaty. But if you look at the performance, you think about a buffer on the forecast, not for a buffer for fishing. So blending the word buffer across waiting until the forecast proves up, which can be late in the game if you have to wait till 50% of the fish are all the way up there, it's kind of late down below. And if you wait till 75% are counted up above, then there's nothing left down below. So I'm just wondering if there's anything you might be able to offer, if you could imagine going into the North of Falcon and trying to make this case that we've heard today, that 6 out of 7 years, can we try something different, whether it be a buffer in different aspects or conservative approach to the forecast or any of the things you've heard, how receptive it would be if we would push that, and what you might offer is other ideas to try to get a little bit better success given the track record.
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, thank you. Ron Warren, Director's Office. So this year's North Falcon, we're hoping to have some of the previous few year major projects done to give us some more focus time. And the list of items that Aaron and Edward showed to commissioners are things that we've not only thought of internally but have talked to our constituents about. They are all on the table. I think that the item that's probably the most well, the, probably the easiest one to talk about are the how we look at our forecast models and how conservative can we be. I think that from a secondary perspective, I think that trying to buffer something and trying to come up with what that buffer would be, where it would be, those types of across fishery that you described, Commissioner McIsaac, I think are appealing to us. I flip that around and I think about the difficulties we have in not only this fishery, in that we are the dead-end fisher, and we flip it around and we look at other fisheries within Puget Sound where the tribes are the dead-end fishers. And I'm not sure that I would be willing to talk about much of a buffer in those types of fisheries. I think that because this population is not listed, that there, we've seen some good signs relative health of the population. I think that we can explore those. I just don't know how receptive we'll all be to buffer something, knowing that if we buffer too much, then are we in a payback situation? Or will that be brought up? We have to weigh all of those things. Strategically, I don't have anything that's off the table right now. I think we will have time to have more detailed conversations about this topic. It's an important topic to us. Certainly an important topic to the people that came and shared information with you today. In my conversations with the director, we're going to make it a very high priority during North Falcon and see if we can't start to move the dial a little bit to make it a more equitable fishery. We have an obligation to do that for our constituents.
If I may, Ron, can you wait till North of Falcon to start the ball rolling? That would seem to be a little late, in my view, because having been to 30-some North of Falcons, I know how busy everyone gets. So I just throw that out. You don't have to answer that now, but just...
I, Chair Carpenter, I'd like to respond to it, if you don't mind. You heard the director mention that next month we will provide a detailed briefing on the Puget Sound Chinook Resource Management Plan. We're still working on that. We've been working on that for 3 years. Also, for the last 3 years, we've been working on details of a comprehensive chum management plan. We saw chum crash this year like we've never seen them crash. Yeah. Across Western Washington. But as we finish that Chinook plan and get into just prior to and into North of Falcon is where I believe that the time will free up a little bit to allow us to focus energy and thought. Not everybody in our department in the fish world are working on that plan. They are looking at what would we look like if we wanted to take a buffer in place? What would those conservative looks for forecasts? Forecasts are done by the end of February. They'll be working on those well in advance of the actual negotiations of fisheries occur. So some of the steps, some of the items that are on there will take place prior to North Falcon. Others will have to wait until we get into North Falcon proper.
Okay, thank you. I just want to close my comments out on this. The Skagit River, I was born on the banks of the Skagit River. I have a little bit of passion for it. The bulrushes, yeah, right, exactly. Number 99. And Director, I know you hear these folks' passion in the room, and I certainly do. I'm very respectful of the tribal rights and opportunity, as we all are. We have to work with them, and we have to continue to improve our relationship with them. And I do respect the economic value that these fish bring to the tribal governments and to their fishermen. The flip side of that, the economics that come out of the recreational fish. These few folks out here, they're recreational fishermen. They're not complaining about what it costs them to go fishing or the tackle they buy at Jaeger's or the license fees or any of that stuff. But the people that get harmed greatly are the merchants up and down Highway 20, in Bellingham too, by the way, but up and down Highway 20, the motels, the restaurants, the bars. I know most people there don't stop at bars, but occasionally they do. And and overnight. And so there's a lot of really, really small mom-and-pop businesses there in Cedar Woolley, Lyman, Hamilton, Concrete that find this to be quite a contribution. So I urge Ron and the director to take this very seriously. So thank you. Excuse me. Mr. Graybill.
I just, before Aaron gets away, many of the people at the table are familiar with Aaron, but I've been at the North of Falcon, and this guy, talk about hard work. This guy is in the pressure cooker, and he and his team are 24/7 down there, and I just wanted to point him out and mention him to you because the incredible work he provides to the staff during the North of Falcon process and beyond, of course, and also a great resource for commissioners that do attend, keeping us abreast of the progress of those meetings. Thank you very much.
Good comments, David. Thank the other thing to bring up, too, to the folks in the audience, North of Falcon is much more local this year than in past years. You don't have to go down to almost San Francisco. There's the North of Falcon 1, North of Falcon 2 that will be here. Locally, up and down the I-5 corridor. And then the wrap-up meeting, the PFMC/North of Falcon, will be in Vancouver, Washington. For those of you that want to open your eyes and get involved, be aware.
Yeah.
Ron, yes.
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Graybill, thank you for the public recognition of Aaron. Got a lot of staff like Aaron, men and women that you've witnessed firsthand. We appreciate you and other commissioners that are there, sometimes just being our cheerleaders. And so thank you for the public recognition for so many people that work so hard there. Appreciate that.
Thank you all very, very much. And that's a nice tie, too, by the way.
We'll talk about Aaron's clothing choices and problems that he had later.
You'll hear about it, I'm sure.
And so will he.
If you find a pair of pants around, you let me know, because I'm missing one.
Little one.
Well, I mean, to find little.
Well, but stand up.
I'll check in my son's closet.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right, we're going to take a 5-minute break, and then we're going to jump immediately into